Welcome to Back from the Abyss. I'm Dr. Craig Heacock. Today's episode is called What I'm Thinking About Now. It's looking like FDA approval for MDMA is coming this year, and I'm both thrilled at this prospect and also a little worried. On the positive side, I think medicalized MDMA is going to revolutionize how we treat complex and developmental trauma, arguably one of the most difficult to treat syndromes in all of psychiatry and psychology. MDMA will help so many people regain their lives, begin to trust and to feel and to love again. And I think it's also going to cause some harm if we aren't very careful. Psychiatrically, the sweet spot of MDMA-assisted therapy is patients with pure trauma, where their anxiety and depression and despair all come out of trauma. And millions of people, in fact, have trauma as their core and primary issue. However, there are also millions of people with trauma and with an endogenous mood or psychotic or anxiety disorder, such as bipolar disorder or OCD or schizoaffective disorder. Many of these folks are going to want to try MDMA therapy, but will face the hurdle of being on various psychiatric meds that interact in potentially dangerous ways with MDMA, or will simply render MDMA ineffective. What I'm seeing in my practice is that patients with significant mental illness, with serious mood and anxiety and psychotic disorders, they cannot and should not go off all their meds in an attempt to do MDMA-assisted therapy. The safer middle ground might look like tapering some psychiatric meds prior to the MDMA session, but not going off the meds completely. But there's still so much we really don't know here. It's becoming increasingly clear to me that most sleep meds, for most people, are basically worthless over the longer term. The sleep research backs this up. In the short term, sleep meds often work quite well. But over a period of weeks, patients build up tolerance as they also develop dependence, whether physical dependence, characterized by physical withdrawal symptoms and insomnia, and or psychological dependence, characterized by pure insomnia. So basically, people have to keep taking sleep meds, not because they're actually quote-unquote working, but rather to avoid the terrible insomnia characteristic of the withdrawal syndromes from the various sleep meds. Now, I've had years of sleep problems, maybe 20, 25 years. I've been on a bunch of different sleep meds, and I've found exactly this. Lots of things work for a little while, then they don't really work that well, but quitting them can be a brutal process. The only thing that seems to work consistently well for insomnia over months and years is to do the hard work of having good sleep hygiene, going to bed and getting up at the same time every day, even on the weekends, getting early morning light in the eyes, avoiding screens and stimulating activities and light in the hour or more before bed, keeping the bedroom totally dark and cool, and greatly minimizing any drug or alcohol use, especially caffeine after midday. One thing that I found particularly useful is to raise my core body temperature in the hour or two before bed, typically in a hot tub. This means getting really, really hot, uncomfortably hot, then getting out of the water and going to bed soon thereafter. This seems counterintuitive, but I've also seen it help a number of my patients, and they often report that they sleep much better. I spend a lot of time with patients on this sleep issue, and I find myself unsuccessfully trying to sell sleep hygiene to desperate insomniacs who want relief now. These behavioral sleep techniques do work quite well for most people, but they can take weeks or months for full efficacy as the circadian rhythm and hormone cycles finally start to synchronize and match the light-dark cues. Now, one major exception to this is a coexisting mood disorder. Sleep and mood are so tightly connected that many of us in psychiatry are now thinking that endogenous mood disorders might be better conceptualized as sleep disorders with psychiatric consequences. In fact, recent research has shown that bipolar disorder appears tightly linked to clock genes in the brain. For my patients with serious depressive or bipolar mood disorders, they often need to be on long-term sleep meds, sedating mood stabilizers or sedating antipsychotics, in order to ensure that they get consistent and predictable sleep. The fastest way to destabilize someone with a mood disorder is to hijack their sleep. Thus, with these folks, I think about sleep meds as essentially mood stabilizers for them, or more accurately, as adjuncts to the mood stabilizing properties of sleep. Now, many of these folks end up on trazodone or quetiapine, with the latter being typically more powerful, but also with metabolic side effects. A final thought on sleep meds. A lot of my patients use THC, CBD, CBN gummies for sleep and say they get a lot of benefit. Now, longtime listeners back from the abyss, you've heard of my misadventures with THC, so I've long been really hesitant to try these gummies for sleep, but I have a funny story to tell here. A couple of years ago, I was in the Bay Area staying with some dear friends, and knowing of my chronic sleep troubles, they offered me a gummy before bed. I said, no way, that I couldn't handle THC, but they insisted. They said, hey, it only has 3 milligrams of THC, along with the CBD and CBN, so what could possibly go wrong? So I finally relented, took the gummy just before bed, and then two fairly surprising things ensued. Number one, over the next 30 to 45 minutes, my mind slowly cracked apart. I began to lose the ability to think, to reason, to feel like a coherent entity with a past, present, and a future. I actually seriously thought I'd broken my brain, that I might need to be hospitalized. Then boom, 8 hours later, I woke up after the deepest night of sleep I can remember in the last 25 years. I looked at the clock. I couldn't believe it. I never, ever sleep through the night without at least a few awakenings. My friends were delighted to hear of my lovely sleep, but alas, on my end, I have to say it wasn't really worth it. 45 minutes of escalating terror to get those dreamy 8 hours. Oh well, at least I tried. I did an ADD episode a couple of seasons ago with Jeremy Sharp, where we went deep into the often ambiguous and misunderstood topic of ADD-ADHD. At the request of some listeners who found that episode a little impenetrable, I'm going to give you my quick and dirty elevator speech about ADD. ADD is a syndrome, not an illness per se, characterized primarily by problems with executive functioning, which means planning, prioritizing, managing time, staying on task. ADD is really a misnomer. It is not primarily an attention deficit problem, but rather a broad spectrum of symptoms that represent various deficits in the domains of executive functioning. And I think this explains why stimulants can be both very helpful for ADD and also frustratingly unhelpful. That's because stimulants make boring things interesting. They crank up the salience circuitry of the brain and allow people to stay focused on things which normally never would have held their attention. However, stimulants do not have that much of an effect on the other domains of executive functioning, such as planning, prioritizing, or managing time. And as I've noted in prior episodes, the great majority of patients complaining of attentional problems in my office do not, in fact, have ADD, but instead they have anxiety, and or poor sleep, and or chaotic blood glucose from unhealthy diets, and or screen addictions. One of the core symptoms of many psychiatric illnesses is avolition, the lack of will, drive, or motivation. Yet I've found that talking about motivation is typically very unhelpful for patients or their families, as the word motivation has an intrinsic aspect of inspiration, a sense that motivation is a feeling or an urge that someone should just simply have and then act upon. Yet typically, if we wait for this thing called motivation, whether we are depressed or not, it more often than not proves frustratingly elusive. I've increasingly asked my patients to strike the word motivation from their vocabulary and clinical complaints and to substitute it with self-discipline. For most of what my patients need, consistent and good sleep, good nutrition, daily exercise, developing and deepening relationships, work, these things don't come about because of motivation. They're all products of self-discipline. My patients improve and get healthier not because they're motivated. They improve because they take responsibility for their lives and accept that self-discipline is the only way forward. Self-discipline is empowering. Motivation is ephemeral, a train that may never actually arrive in the station. For as humans, what are we actually motivated to do? To eat, sleep, have sex? That's really about it. Everything else starts with self-discipline. I love to hear people talk about what ideas they used to believe and have now discarded, the things that seemed abundantly and obviously true and now seem fairly ridiculous and dated. I believed all sorts of things through my life that didn't turn out to be true. Let's see, like, you remember learning that we all are born with a certain number of brain cells and then it's a steady progression downward from there? Bzzz, wrong. Here's another thing I used to believe, that benzodiazepines, the benzos, that they're generally safe, fairly innocuous, and no real worries about taking them long-term. Bzzz, wrong again. There are only two commonly abused substances that have a withdrawal syndrome characterized by seizures and death: alcohol and benzodiazepines. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they call benzos booze in a pill, and I think there's a lot of truth there. Now, that said, I do think benzos have an important place in psychiatry, at least for now. And for this reason, one benzodiazepine, lorazepam, made my top 10 best psych meds list. However, we in psychiatry need to think about these meds as limited-term interventions and keep doses as low as possible for the shortest time possible. Similar to sleep meds, longer-term benzodiazepine use leads to tolerance, dependence, and also the nasty reality of rebound anxiety. In other words, over time, benzos stop, quote-unquote, working, but you have to keep taking them, both to manage the physical dependency and also the reality that each time your blood level of the benzo drops, you are headed into anxiety land. Benzos make you more anxious over time, the same way long-term opioid use leads to decreased pain tolerance. And then there's the emerging research that is linking long-term benzodiazepine use to dementia. Scary stuff. And a final note on benzos, so many medical people do not understand the power of these meds. Last month, one of my patients who moved out of state started with a new psych provider who started her on 2 milligrams of clonazepam twice daily, which is roughly the same as 8 milligrams of lorazepam twice daily. Complete insanity. This would be like going from 0 shots of vodka to, I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 shots twice daily. I really think there should be some kind of requirement that prescribers have to try controlled substances themselves before they're allowed to prescribe them. Because if this prescriber had ever taken a 2 milligram clonazepam, he or she would have found themselves knocked out on the couch for a few hours at least, or even worse, trying to drive to work while severely impaired. Oh man. And sadly, this anecdote is frighteningly common. How long should I stay on my meds? This is one of the most difficult to answer questions that we regularly hear in psychiatry. I remember a medicine attending during med school rounds who once told us, anybody can start a patient on a medication. It takes a real doctor to know how and when to stop it. I remember being both surprised and kind of fascinated when I heard this, but as I now enter my third decade in psychiatry, I see this as more true than ever. The complexity of this question starts with the fact that we often don't really know why patients get better or worse. During my years of working on inpatient units, I remember so many patients on their day of discharge saying, I'm feeling a lot better. The meds have started to work. Yet most of these stays were a few days at best, not nearly enough time for mood meds to make a major difference. Almost surely, they were feeling better due to some combination of an improved sleep schedule, regular meals with others, individual group therapy, and a time out from life stressors. Or with my current patients, when I walk out to the waiting room and see someone give me a big smile, see them radiate energy and hope, looking forward to connecting with me and others, I'm asking myself, is this the Lamotrigine or the new girlfriend or maybe the start of daylight savings time or 21 days off weed and alcohol or all the above or none of the above? And I think this is both one of the most challenging and also most interesting parts of this work, trying to partner with patients to figure out what are the ingredients in the special sauce of their recovery? What do they need more of in their lives? And what's got to go? A typical patient coming to me for a consult or second opinion might be on 3 or 5 or more psych meds. I always go through each medication and ask the patient how much they think that med is helping. And the usual response is, I have no idea. I tell all my patients, I don't want them on any medication, including non-psychiatric medications, unless we are both confident that there's some significant benefit. This then often leads to a plan to slowly and sequentially taper off one or more of their psych meds. For most of my patients, given that they often have difficult to treat mood and anxiety and psychotic disorders, meds are almost always going to be part of the picture. Not the whole picture, but an essential piece. But how long should someone stay on a medication that we're pretty darn sure is making a significant difference? Well, I think we should consider at least 2 major factors here. 1, how long has the patient struggled with this illness? And 2, what are the relative risks of illness relapse versus long-term medication side effects? Some psychiatric illnesses start relatively early in life and tend to persist throughout the lifespan. These include OCD and its related illnesses, bipolar mood disorder, schizophrenia. Without ongoing lifelong treatment, which more often than not includes medication, chronic psychiatric illnesses will all tend towards regular relapses or even worsening over time. If, however, someone shows up in my office with a life history of generally doing well psychiatrically, but then for some reason they've developed psychiatric symptoms over recent months or even the last year or two, this predicts a totally different course of treatment, including time-limited medication treatment. It really matters how long you've been sick, whether we're talking pneumonia or migraines or depression. A history of chronic, near-lifelong symptoms, whether medical or psychiatric, is a strong predictor of problems into the foreseeable future. Symptoms of weeks or months' duration, in contrast, these are much more likely to resolve without long-term treatment. Ever since lurasidone went generic, I've been thinking I need to update my top 10 psych med list. I think I would boot aripiprazole off the list and replace it with lurasidone, which is turning out to be probably safer and also roughly equal in terms of efficacy. However, I haven't yet figured out how to sneak one more med on the list. I really like the remaining 9, but if I could get one more psych med on the list, it would definitely be propranolol. Propranolol is an adrenaline blocker, often used for hypertension, but also a very powerful tool to manage anxiety. Medication-wise, in psychiatry, we basically have 3 major ways to meaningfully address anxiety: SSRIs, benzodiazepines, and propranolol, and other beta blockers. What I like about propranolol is that you can take it as needed. It's not addictive. It doesn't typically cause sedation or cognitive impairment. and it gets to the core circuitry of panic because it blocks the fight-flight adrenaline response. Taking propranolol is like disconnecting the smoke detectors in your house. For many folks with anxiety, their smoke detectors, their fight-flight system, it's going off sporadically or even constantly, yet there's no smoke, no fire, no actual threat. But 20 to 40 milligrams of propranolol 1 hour prior to high-stress situations, it's like a magic spell. The mind can start to race with thoughts of dread, yet the body stays calm. And through a feedback loop, the mind steadily calms, realizing that the body's alarms aren't going off. The heartbeat stays steady and slow. That sick feeling in the gut, the pressure in the chest, they're nowhere to be found. One of the diagnostic dilemmas we face in psychiatry every day is the question of borderline versus bipolar. Both are characterized by mood instability, work and relationship problems, intermittent hopelessness and suicidality, substance abuse, yet they are different in at least one critical way. And this is how you can usually sort this question out quickly. And note here, these two diagnoses can definitely occur together, so that calls for a much more nuanced evaluation. A core difference between borderline and bipolar is that bipolar disorder is, at its core, arguably a type of sleep disorder. The mood, energy, and thought content changes in bipolar disorder are always accompanied by significant changes in sleep. In contrast with borderline personality disorder, assuming no significant trauma, these patients often sleep just fine. And if they do have sleep problems, they tend towards insomnia, not the major swings between hypersomnia and insomnia that we see with bipolar spectrum mood disorders. A side note here, there's a school of thought that borderline personality disorder is always a result of trauma, typically developmental parent-child trauma. I think this is a gross oversimplification. There is a major Venn diagram overlap between trauma and BPD, but I've worked with a lot of patients over the years with no apparent trauma history who had BPD. And in these cases, it seems like there's often a major genetic influence, probably related to the 5 inherited components of personality, as well as inherited tendencies towards impulsivity, having quote-unquote big emotions, as well as developmental problems with self-soothing. It took me many years to learn this, and I'm fairly embarrassed to admit that. But self-care is basically for naught if you work excessively long hours in a stressful job day after day, week after week, year after year. I worked 9 to 11 hour days for over 20 years, and it took a huge toll on me. Exhaustion, addiction, burnout, lost time with family, probably more. It's only been in the last couple of years that I've started to work what I would consider a semi-sane schedule. Usually 7.5 clinical hours, 4 days a week, then 1 day a week for catching up, working on the podcast, doing clinical supervision, and seeing my trainer. And that still actually sounds like a lot, because it is. Part of me, the long-distance runner part of me, wants to think that he or she who pushes hardest and goes longest is the winner. But the winner of what and at what cost? I'm still trying to figure out this work-life balance, and I'm increasingly realizing that it's probably a big myth. There is no balance, just a series of compromises that we either unconsciously march through or hopefully at some point begin to approach with intention and mindfulness. My wife and I recently listened to Terry Real's book called Us, and I would say it's made our marriage at least 20% better. Why? Terry introduces us to the idea of the wise adult and the adaptive child, the former being the person who we are when things are going our way, and the latter being who we can regress to in times of stress or fear or conflict. And surprise, surprise, the ongoing conflicts that my wife and I have had for years, as with all married couples, are exactly this phenomenon. She becomes the ignored little girl who demands to be heard and seen and validated, and I become the little boy who sneaks away, lays low, hides out, who says whatever I have to say to make the hard emotions go away. We've been practicing identifying our adaptive child when it comes out, having some compassion for it, then asking it to step aside so the wise adult can come back into the situation and establish safety and calm. 30 years of marriage, and we're still learning stuff. Then Terry goes on to describe the absolutely critical process of repair. Most every couple fights, and of note, the ones who don't are bound for other troubles. Because most every couple fights, and successful couples prioritize the process of repair. Terry asks us each to reach out to our partners, to ask them what they need for repair, and then, after the repair attempt, to check back in and see if the repair was adequate. You can be right, or you can stay married, he loves to say. I couldn't agree more.